Welcome to Talking Books on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series I discuss books and what they mean to my guests on the programme. I'm delighted to have with me in the studio today for this, the first edition of Talking Books, Professor Joe Frigeri. Professor Frigeri needs, of course, little introduction, as he's clearly a well-known figure here in Maltese society. Apart from being head of the Department of Philosophy here at the University, he's a writer of poetry and short stories in both English and Maltese, and also an author of philosophical works such as In Mizja Talhasib, which in fact he has presented on this Radio Campus FM. He's also a playwright and a four times winner of the National Literary Award. Today he's here to talk about a book that he clearly feels is important, both to him personally and to many, many others. In fact, I suppose I shouldn't have been very surprised when I asked him what book he was going to choose to talk about, and I saw that his choice had fallen upon Plato's Republic. Of course, his declaration sent me scurrying off to check up on my faded memories of Plato and his place in the pantheon of world philosophers, and about his most famous work. Welcome, Professor Frigeri.
Thank you very much for your invitation, which I gladly accept.
I suppose to ask what is the book about would set us off on a very long journey. Perhaps one could ask really why this book of philosophical thought is the one that even people who are not really into philosophy would mention if you ask them, do you know a book of philosophical thought? And most people would probably be able to say, Plato's Republic. Well, why is that?
Right, it's a fair question, a book written in the 4th century BC. Why should it be of any interest to us who are now reading it in the 21st century? Well, as a matter of fact, it's of interest because of the themes of the subject matter it deals with, because of the issues it raises, which are of perennial interest, I would say. For instance, let's say that the official aim, the official purpose of the writing of the Republic by Plato was to try to answer this question about justice. What is justice? And Plato's trying to do that in the form of a dialogue by trying to respond to a number of challenges that are thrown in at him in the first book of the Republic by various people, by the interlocutors that are taking part in the debate, because in a dialogue form, that's one of the interesting things about Plato's writings, that he's always used this form, the dialogue form, in which he tries to answer, to rebut, to reject, really, to produce arguments against the positions of the other interlocutors in the dialogue, in the conversation. These are conversation pieces, so the style is also quite fascinating. And of course, Plato writes in this kind of what has been called the golden style of Greek prose. We're lucky because what we have are his esoteric writings, that is, the writings which he meant, which he intended for a kind of public audience, the general audience, and not just for the members of his academy, that is, of the school which he set up in Athens. So the style is reader-friendly, and that's one of the reasons why I think the Republic is still such a popular work. But again, the issues that the Republic is dealing with are of perennial interest. They're of interest to people who are interested in education. For example, what kind of education should we offer our children? They're of interest to people who are interested in aesthetics. What he says about art and artists in the ideal state is quite shocking by modern standards. But he's also interesting, of course, for people who are even vaguely interested in politics, and how politics should be conducted, and who should rule, for example. That's one of the interesting things that is raised by the Republic, which doesn't mean, of course, that we need to agree with the answers that Plato gives to the questions. But still, there are a number of issues, and maybe we'll have time later on in the program to deal with those that are of great interest even to the contemporary reader, to contemporary audiences.
In fact, this idea of the Republic, perhaps you could outline the main issues that he talks about,
right.
Who should rule, how should he rule, what are the main elements?
Right. The book is called The Republic, obviously, because what Plato is doing there is trying to give us an outline, a blueprint of an ideal state. And that comes out gradually in the book, because one of the questions that are very often asked in examination papers and students have to grapple with and try to answer is precisely this: what is the Republic about? Because the Republic seems to be about a lot of things. Ostensibly, as I was saying, the kind of official aim of the Republic is to try to define justice. But in order to get there, Plato takes a very tortuous route. And in the first book, there are a number of people who are giving sort of kind of pat definitions of justice. Justice is doing good to one's friends and harming one's enemies. Justice is returning goods to the rightful owner. Justice, and then there's a definition of justice, which again is quite shocking, quite Machiavellian, and this is given by the definition made by Trasimachus, the sophist, who's been waiting sort of in the wings very impatiently, and then he comes forward and says, justice is nothing other than the advantage of the stronger party, and it's the same everywhere, that's what he says, okay? So justice is really the good of another. Right. If you act justly, then Trasimachus says you're acting against your own interests, and we need to try to understand this, you know, because it's a very bold claim that Trasimachus is making. A just man always gets less than an unjust one. Let's give some examples. In contracts, for example, when the partnership ends, a just partner gets less than an unjust one. The just pay more taxes, and they get nothing out of refunds. Right, and so that's the challenge. So for Trasimachus, really, only the stupid are just. The clever prefer injustice.
But what he
and Socrates, Plato is using Socrates as his mouthpiece all the time. I mean, this is a conversation that was reported 20 years after it was supposed to have taken place. Plato, using Socrates as his mouthpiece, is trying to give answers, to give cogent and convincing replies to these challenges. For example, there's another challenge in the first book that's presented by Glaucon, who is one of Plato's elder brothers. The other brother is Adeimantus. And Glaucon says, okay, maybe it's not as Trasimachus is saying, but let's suppose that one was in possession of Gyges' ring, this very lovely story. Plato is in the habit of telling stories because he's a great raconteur. You know, let's suppose that you were in possession of this ring that made you invisible. Right, then how would you act? Okay, and this is a challenge. Would you act justly if you knew that you could be unjust, that you could act unjustly with impunity, that is, if you're not caught? How would you act? And this is a challenge. I mean, what would one do, or how would one behave given a choice? Would one do what is considered to be now unjust, or would he act justly? And Glaucon is pushing the argument a step further than it had been taken by Trasimachus by saying, if one could act unjustly with impunity, then that's what most people would do, right? And that's a big challenge. And of course, that's what Socrates is trying to reject as an argument.
Yes, if you knew you were going to get away with cheating,
right,
then everyone would cheat.
Well, that's the challenge, yeah. Right? That's the challenge. So why shouldn't you cheat if you could get away with it? That's a good way of putting it. Why shouldn't you act unjustly if you knew you weren't going to get caught? You know?
Does Socrates give do you feel that he does actually give answers to that? Because when you read some of the, you know, some criticisms that I've read very briefly, you know, the idea that obviously he's saying there's no black and it's not black and white. Mm. There are grey areas. But then once you get into grey areas, things, definitions sort of start to blur.
No, I think that Plato, using Socrates as his mouthpiece, does give cogent answers to that initial challenge. And the way he does it, of course, it takes him the whole of 9 books, the rest of the Republic, to do that. But he does it in this way. He uses one argument, right? And that's the argument of the healthy soul, right? That's how it starts. The healthy or the harmonious soul, which is structured in such a way as to make reason the dominant element. And then he says, but if we want to understand justice in the individual, we should start with justice in the state, because there we're projecting the issue, the idea, onto a larger scale, justice writ large. So as it turns out, justice in the state and justice in the individual run along parallel lines. There's a construction of justice in the individual soul, the parts of the soul, and then there's a construction of justice in the ideal state, Kallipolis, which is again more or less structured along the same lines. So the soul has 3 parts, reason, will or spirit, and appetite or desire. And in the same way, the state is going to have 3 parts, the guardians, the philosopher kings who are on top, the auxiliaries, the soldiers, and then the producers or artisans. Now, Plato's definition of justice is always in terms of a harmony between parts, right? And there's harmony in the soul if reason is in control. The idea which you find in the Phaedrus, in that myth of the charioteer who tries to keep the 2 horses, the good horse and the bad horse, the docile horse and the unruly horse, and the charioteer, reason, trying to keep these 2 horses in check, under control. And you have the same idea when Plato is talking about the harmonious soul. Unless reason is in control, then what you have is chaos, disruption. The idea is harmony. And in the state, unless those who know what justice is all about, then you'd have chaos in the state. And the 3 virtues, right, the 3 virtues, wisdom, which is attributed to the philosopher king, courage, that's the virtue of the auxiliaries, and then temperance or obedience, which applies to the rest of the population, those 3 virtues should also then be the virtues of the ideal state. So justice is going to consist in the harmonious interplay between parts, where everybody is doing what he is more or less by nature more inclined to do, right? What he's more suited for. The kind of job, one man, one job, division of labor, is what is ideal in the ideal state. If you don't do that, then you have complete confusion. Roles need to be kept clearly distinct. That's one of the things that Plato is telling us about how the ideal state ought to be organized. But the other metaphor, I mean, the first metaphor is the metaphor of harmony, the balanced soul, and the other metaphor is the metaphor of health, right? And that's again something which Socrates speaks about in the Apology. The health of the soul, the healthy soul, is one in which there's this harmony between all the parts that constitute it, that make it up. This analogy reminds us a little bit of Freud, doesn't it? I mean, Freud also divides the personality into these 3 parts. And we shouldn't take the word parts too literally, but anyway, 3 aspects, let's say, of the personality, with the ego in the middle, the superego on top, and the id, instincts of Eros and Thanatos at the bottom. And again, Freud's idea is that the balanced personality will be one in which these parts are acting harmoniously. Okay, there's not too much superego, there isn't too much control, right? But at the other at the other end, right, we are not the victims of passions, and we are not ruled by passions, but governed by reason. Not easy, but that is the kind of picture that Plato is giving us, trying to give, in order to try to answer Trasimachus' challenge at the beginning. So the answer basically becomes this. Nobody would do anything, nobody in the right senses would do anything to harm their bodies, so nobody in the right senses would do anything to harm their souls. And the same thing would apply to the state.
Tell us a little bit more about this figure of the philosopher king. Why a king, and why a philosopher?
Right, okay. If it is true, as Plato believes is true, that it's the wise man that should rule, because the wise man knows what's good for the state, right, that's the idea, then the philosopher who's gone through a very long period of training, who's been educated for that job, should be the one who's in charge. Basileus just means ruler there, even though, of course, the ideal state for Plato would be a monarchy. If it's difficult to find this ideal person, the one person who combines all these virtues, then, of course, the next best thing is to go for aristocracy. The word ariston, of course, means good or the best. So what Plato is saying is the state should be ruled by those who have all the necessary qualities to be good rulers, right, and who could dedicate the lives, the energies, to just doing that one thing, rule the state. Why philosophers? Because philosophers are those who have a knowledge of the essence of things. Plato has the central idea in the Republic, which he also develops elsewhere, that real knowledge consists of knowledge of essences of things, of ideas or forms. What he means there is that when you compare, for example, human justice to ideal justice, you'll always find that human justice is in some way always imperfect. You will never find the perfect judge, and you will also never find the perfect law. You'll never find a judge who applies law always in the right way. Judges make mistakes. But this kind of imperfection, right, is sort of inherent in anything that is an object of human experience. Plato then wants the philosopher king to try to go through that process of education. It's a very long process that starts at a young age, in order to get to knowledge of essences, knowledge of the good. Unless he's gone through this. And there are in the Republic two very beautiful analogies, the analogy of the cave and the analogy of the divided line. In the analogy of the cave, you have a group of people who are tied to the ground from birth with chains from their necks and feet, and they're facing the inner wall of the cave. a dark cave with the back to the entrance of the cave. Behind them, there's a wall, and behind the wall there are puppeteers who are operating, who are manipulating these puppets, and behind the puppeteers there's a fire. So the idea is that the fire is going to project images or shadows of the puppets onto the inner wall. So what the people at large, the prisoners in the cave, are looking at are just these shadows. They're not looking at reality. They're just looking at vague, faint, flickering images. It's kind of a puppet show, right? But they're not even looking at the puppets. They're just looking at the shadows that are projected by the fire, as if they were projected onto a screen, the inner wall of the cave, until one of the men, of the people in the cave, manages to cut himself loose, to cut the chains, and he goes out and is at first blinded by the sun. The sun is the vision of the good, all right? The sun is the vision of justice, of beauty. And then he goes back, and of course he tries to convert the prisoners to that vision. He's not very successful, even though the Republic was written when Plato was still an optimist, so he thought that things could change. Later on in the Laws, he becomes much more realistic. But at any rate, that's the idea. It's the person who has now come into contact with the idea of the good, the wise person, the really wise person. We'd call them we'd call them experts nowadays, okay, who ought to rule, because they know what's good for the citizens, not just what's good for themselves, because that's the tyrant, right, who's always acting on Trasimachus's advice, right, and we go back to the beginning, right, it's only the tyrant who's seeking his own self-interest, but the good doctor is not trying to line up his pockets with money, he's trying to do what's good for the patient, right, and this idea of health comes back there again. The philosopher king is doing with what's good for everybody, that's the meaning of justice, and that's why he should rule. And then in the other analogy, the analogy of the divided line, as it's called, people are seen as progressing, the philosopher king is seen as progressing from an initial state, which corresponds to the contact with the images. What he's seeing there is pistis and eikasia, right, just illusions, dreams, the products of art. Okay, and then he moves up one step, and he starts learning mathematics, but mathematics are still dealing with hypotheses, until he gets up to the final stage, the climbing up the ladder of knowledge, where he gets episteme, that is true knowledge, basic knowledge of the essence of things. So that's why. And the philosopher king in Plato has this huge responsibility, and he's also leading a very ascetic kind of life. You see, he's not allowed to have property, he's not allowed to have wealth, he's not allowed to marry, to have a family, okay? He can't have a family. As soon as the children of the guardians are born, they're taken away from their parents and brought up by the state in a creche. But he's not allowed to have any property whatsoever, because Plato believed, and I don't know whether you agree, that politicians are very often open to bribes. People in power can give in to the temptation. You know, they exercise power, and they know that with a little bit of help from their friends, they could also become rich in the exercise of their duties, whereas what they should be doing is really making good laws for the citizens. So when you ask, why is it still relevant, why is the Republic still such an important book? It's because it deals with all these kinds of problems. It's a combination of politics and ethics. Right? For the Greeks, there wasn't this kind of distinction that we make nowadays between public and private morality. For them, these two things were more or less the same. You couldn't say I'm a private citizen and I'm not interested in public affairs. Pericles, in his famous oration at the end of the first year of the war against Sparta, says it quite clearly that people who are not interested in politics, for us, are not harmful, they're just useless. But whereas nowadays we tend to think, well, politics is not for me, I'm not interested, it's a dirty game, right? So I think there's a lot of that. Plato is trying to tell us it shouldn't be a dirty game, but in order not for it not to be a dirty game, then certain conditions would have to be observed, certain conditions would have to be fulfilled. And in the Republic, that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to spell out those conditions which would lead to harmony and health, a harmonious state and a healthy state, a just state.
Listening to you describe the story of the shadows and the caves and the Republic in general, you can see, in a way, how it has been useful or used by various people who are various areas of society, groups in society, who have had extremely diverse views. In actual fact, it's influenced writers who have different aims in their writing. Why is it? Is it because it's ambiguous in any way, or why can it be used by so many people who have different ideas, really?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that in the Republic, Plato says a number of very interesting things that are positive and that people could agree with. But he also says a number of things that are, to say the least, controversial, and other things that are quite awful. For example, this idea of the rulers of the state, the governors, our politicians, not having a family, for example, or of children being taken away from their parents at birth to be brought up in creches by the state. And that's something which nobody in the right senses would accept. He's also very critical of democracy, but that's the subject for another program, you know, because he defines democracy as mob rule. Now, he's very critical of democracy, because in a democracy, everybody seems to be an expert at everything. Now, that's his basic criticism, whereas his ideal state is for a state to be run by experts, experts who have, who must have superior knowledge, who must have incorruptible virtue to avoid abuse of power. Now, of course, it's very difficult to identify a group of political leaders as having these two qualities. So that's one of the criticisms. And then, of course, there's also a touch of paternalism there. And a question, the question then becomes, can one presume that the few will understand the interests of the people better than the mass of people themselves? And that's a very interesting question, and I think that one needs to discuss that. So Plato may be wrong about that. There's also a complete lack. Plato shows very little respect for autonomy in the Republic, and it's this neat division into classes, right? Making this a very rigid structure, that you can be seen as belonging to a class.
And staying there.
Well, not quite staying there, because Plato allows for some social mobility. That is, you can have members of the artisan class, of the producers, being promoted to the class of auxiliaries. You can also have women among the guardians, and you can also have demotion from the guardian class downwards if the guardians don't behave as they should. But there's very little of that. But the idea one gets when one reads the Republic is this a kind of a rigid caste system, and we don't seem to agree with that. We seem to say we ought to give everybody the chance, the opportunity to become what they want to become. You know, the idea there is that there isn't one single good that people aim at, but there's a multiplicity or a pluralism of good things which people might aim at. So those are two possible criticisms.
Well, we've come to the end of our time this morning. Thank you very, very much, Professor Frigeri, and I thank you for pushing me into going back to look at Plato's Republic, and I really enjoyed that and got a lot out of it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Talking Books. I hope you can join us next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.